Group meeting, Saturday, 13th February, 1988. We have started the chapter on the teachers of the Upanishads. I think all of you know that the word Upanishad literally means sitting at the feet of the master and listening to what he has to say. Listening is the first step, then reflection is the second step, and then nididhyasana, meditation, is the culminating part of the teaching. But the meaning of meditation is not what I mean by meditation. The dictionary meaning is musing, pondering upon a particular subject, especially something religious or something of deep import. But this sort of musing is only inaudible talking. The real meditation begins at the culminating point of our spiritual development, which means that it begins when a person is able to enter into what I call holistic consciousness. That is to say, a consciousness which functions in the context of infinity and eternity and is not confined all the time to the context of the finite and the temporal, which is the mortal. Now, when one is able to be sensitive to that holistic consciousness, then maintaining that consciousness, one is actually more or less performing creative action in eternity. Now, this is a terrible sounding phrase, perhaps, but I think it is the fact. This is what actually happens. It is creative activity. And creative activity is something which we ordinary mortals know nothing about. We talk of the creative work of a great artist or scientist or philosopher and so on. And we say this is creative. It is not creative. It is procreative. All the work of the artist, the scientist, the philosopher is cultural procreation. The difference between the two is just this. Procreation brings into being that which is true to type. An acorn will only produce an oak tree. It can't produce a human being. A mosquito can't produce an elephant. And a human being will give birth only to human beings. That means that that which is brought forth, that to which is given birth, is true to type. Human beings are all alike in certain respects. Oak trees are all alike in certain respects, and so on and so on. But creation actually means something utterly new, something which never was and never will be repeated. That is creation. And it comes out of, for lack of any proper word in any language in the world, it comes out of nothing. No thing. You see, the word thing and the word reality represents the material universe. And the material universe is finite, temporal, mortal. And it functions at least always in dualistic terms. Creation creativeness has no dualism about it at all. One has quite transcended dualism for the simple reason that it is the dualistic aspect of our life which is the aspect that produces conflict, struggle, sorrow, misery, and all the rest of it. Now, let us go on where we left off last time. Person is a sacred word. The Upanishads do not hesitate to use their own suggestive methods, even if they are somewhat quaint, to enlighten the devotee. This is how person is defined in the Upanishads. In the beginning, now of course in the beginning has no meaning actually in truth. In reality it has. It starts, proceeds and dies. But but in actuality, in truth, there is no meaning to the phrase in the beginning. But what language can we use? It is not possible to produce new words, new sounds, which would symbolize that which is transcendent to us. Well, in the beginning, there was only the Atma. Looking around and seeing seeing nothing other than itself, it said, "I am." Of course, the language as it stands is really quite foolish. If you want to look at it and analyze it and criticize it quite logically and rationally. But there we are. And then it goes on to say something extremely suggestive. Because formally, the Sanskrit word is purva, all this, the Atma burned up. Before all this, the Atma burned up all evils, therefore he is a person. The root of the verb to burn is ush, and purva has pur. So putting the two together, make purusha, and that is the person. In other words, the significance of the word person is that the individual being who has reached the culmination of his evolution and development. Purusha. Atma is devoid of all evils. They manifest only in all this. In the Upanishads, all this is used to typify the whole world, the universe. The existential world as experienced and cognized by us in our impure state by our tainted, discriminative consciousness. Our consciousness as it functions now is a discriminative consciousness. Discriminative, analytical, and therefore separative and isolative. It splits up things. It splits up the unity of the universe. You know what the word universe means. It comes from unus, meaning one, the Latin unus, and vertere, the verb vertere, meaning to turn. So that literally, the word universe means turned into a unity. You see? All evils, sarvam papanam, are all evil states of mind. Mind is emphasized because as far as our ordinary everyday existential life is concerned, everything begins with the mind. It originates in the mind, desire in the mind, and then the thought process by which we try to fulfill our desire and so forth. All that starts in the mind. So evil really originates in the mind. Are all evil states. Out of the heart comes evil. I think that's a statement in the Bible, isn't there? Out of the heart comes all evil. Evil mentation is the evidence of the sick heart and the diseased mind. The word heart is used not exactly identical with mind. It is that feeling aspect which of consciousness, of our mental life, the feeling aspect which does not know by analysis. It just knows somehow. You know how the mother knows just what the newborn infant needs and wants and so forth. She has this peculiar sensitivity which we can call knowledge up to a point. But knowledge, strictly speaking, belongs just to the intellectual activity. It burned up all evils. Now, how do you burn up evil? Ordinarily, and as a matter of fact, practically all the religions have made this mistake. They talk in turn, when I say religions, I mean the conventional scriptures as such, which were written by men. Burning up, in the scriptures, they talk of overcoming evil. Oh, if you want to overcome something, you have to fight against it. That precisely is the mistake. You don't need to fight against anything whatsoever, because that only emphasizes conflict and increases conflict, increases one's state of disequilibrium. What one has to do is to understand evil. You understand evil as you understand anything, by observing it dispassionately, without taking sides for or against anything whatsoever. Reject whatsoever comes to your consciousness. Don't reject it. Just observe it, look at it. And if one can look at it dispassionately, without trying to destroy it or fight against it, what happens is that an element of, I could almost say, creativeness emerges out of your being. There is a loving sympathy with what you are observing. And in that, and through that loving sympathy, understanding grows. And when understanding grows, then there is right relationship between you and that which you are observing. And in that right relationship, peace can be established and harmony can come into being. So it's very important not to fight against evil, not to try to destroy it. That's a mistake. Where does the evil come from? It comes from me, myself. If I fight against myself, I'll end up by killing myself. What a magnificent idiot I'd be to do that. So, observe without criticism, without judgment. You will know somehow or other this is helpful towards the right development, or it is against it. And what is against it will naturally drop off because you are in a state of inner peace and balance. Now, the word used for burning up in the text is tapas. Tapas comes from tap. The root is tap, which means to warm up, to get hot. It also means to watch, to observe. You find the word tapasin to represent he who is very observant. And in the Sanskrit-derived languages of India, tapas means examining, examining carefully. And you can't examine carefully if you have any bias or prejudice, assumption or preconception to start with. You have to just look and observe, just look, keep looking. So tapas is pure attentiveness, which by its energy, its intensity, generates that psychical heat, agni, which burns up all evil-mindedness. I've said which burns up, but I should have written actually which transmutes all evil-mindedness. Nothing is destroyed, nothing is burnt up. Everything has to undergo transmutation out of the limited, finite and temporal state into the infinite, eternal state. You won't be able to see it happen, but it will happen and will keep on happening if you go about it the right way. That's the great thing. The brain knowledge will come later on because it will so affect the whole organism, the whole psychophysical organism, that sooner or later, as what we call a thought or a series of thoughts will emerge, which come out of the realization in the silence of this transmuted, transcendent state. He who has burned up all evil-mindedness is now the pure one. In this state, he, the Holy One, knowing that that Holy One is realized on earth through him, is named Purusha. The person. That is the meaning, the profoundest meaning possible of the word person. A person is one in whom the second and third orders, I've been talking about this in past meetings, mind only and the natural man after his baptism by fire are in harmony. And in this holy state of first personhood, the I am, the transcendent I am, the full significance of man is realized. This I am comes in Exodus chapter 3 verse 14, when out of the burning bush Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, says to Moses, when Moses asks him, when the Israelites in Egypt ask me, who hath sent you? The Lord God says, say unto them, Ehye Asher Ehye. I, Moses, am that transcendent I am, Yahweh Elohim itself. This man is transcendence thinking. Now, our thinking is mainly almost 100% inaudible talking. It's chatter which revolves round just our worldly questions and problems and difficulties and so on, and essentially it revolves round oneself. If you watch your thought process for even 2 or 3 minutes, you will be astounded to discover how many times the word I comes in that thought process. I, number one. Everything else is the not self. I am the self. But the totality of the universe, everything outside my skin is the not self. And you see, this is the abysmal ignorance from which proceeds so many, well, thousands and millions of our difficulties. When consciousness has reached the culminating point of its development and become holistic consciousness, otherness is completely out of that consciousness. There is no other. There is only the one total reality present. And in that unity is the transcendent unity of the source from which we come. So, when I say transcendent thinking, one mustn't imagine it to be something like our thinking, our talking. Thinking really means, should mean, the creative energy in action. You get the hints of this in the Trismegistic writings. There are 3 volumes of translations. In the 2nd volume, somewhere around page 12, you will find a very remarkable statement. Then, All Father Mind, God is called All Father Mind, having created all the rest of the world and so on, brought forth man co-equal to himself. His own child, with whom he fell in love and bestowed upon him all his powers. Now, how many of us are able to exercise the transcendent powers of the Creator God in our lives? But that is the fact. That's how the creation of man took place. You find in Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27, Elohim, God, said, let us, this is my translation, I don't like the usual English translation. Let us create man, not make man. Let us create man in our own, not image, but in our own living likeness. And that is why, having created the primordial archetypal man in thought, the thought in the mind of God, as we put it, in that way, man was placed in the Garden of Eden. Eden literally means delight. That is the translation usually given. I don't like it. I would rather say bliss. Bliss which has no sensational element in it. But that bliss which is the ineffable peace and plenitude of the transcendent source of everything. So that is the meaning of Eden. Bliss. And man was placed there. This is the conceptual man, conceived in the mind, the thought in the mind of God, as the Trismegistic writings put it. Now, the thought, the mind of God is not like our brains or any such thing, which only chatter. But the mind of God is the formative aspect of the creative energy the primordial creative energy. It gives form and shape to that which in its ultimate sense has no form and no shape. Otherwise no universe could come into being. That's how the universe comes into being, this mode in which that primordial creative energy functions is what we call mind. It's a formative mode, and the universe in the shape and form it has comes into being. So that thinking, therefore, is really the meaning of logos, the word, the creative word, the Son of God. Ma'amar, I think in Hebrew, isn't it? Ma'amar is this creative word. In the Zarathustrian scriptures, you have Ahuna Vairya. In St. John's Gospel, you have, in the beginning was the Word. And note what he says. The Word was God. The Word was with God. And the Word was God. This word, God, it's a wonderful monosyllable. Who knows its true meaning? It is transcendent. It is beyond our ken. We don't know what we mean when we say God, or when we say Brahman, or Allah, or Ahura Mazda, or whatever word we use, or Atma. We don't know the meanings. We are making a sound to represent that which is utterly beyond us, utterly transcendent. You might ask me, what makes you say such things? I'll tell you. During my lifetime, from my childhood, very young childhood, I was a freak. I was interested in the meaning of immortality and the meaning of God and the meaning of heaven and so on. And nobody could really tell me what it all meant. Looking carefully into myself, into things, for practically 70 years altogether, I realized quite clearly that what I know is that I do not know. When some insight, great insight comes to you, then it opens up ranges and ranges of mountains of truth which were hidden before you. And you can't put it into words. When we say no, we mean by that something which we can talk about, which we can put into words, explain to somebody and so forth. But this inexplicability of the insight which opens up transcendent realms is one of the great characteristics of the transcendent. So, when we make a sound, a word is a sound, it's a symbolic sound. When we make a sound, God, transcendence, I prefer transcendence because it is not so loaded as the word God or Brahman or Atma. These other words which we use are heavily loaded through our ignorance. We say God is like this, like that, like that. And if you look at I've looked through practically all the religions, the religious scriptures, which talk about God and what God is and so on and so on. And really, all those descriptions are only projections out of man's brain, apotheosizing the qualities which he himself believes are good qualities. That is all. I am kind, therefore God is absolute kindness. I love, therefore God is absolute love. I know a little bit of arithmetic and so on, therefore God is the absolute arithmetician. In fact, Plato said God geometrizes. No, Plato said many wonderful things which people haven't really appreciated. They haven't penetrated into what lay deep inside Plato's enlightened mind, which made him use those words. And the same with Pythagoras. So, this man, transcendence thinking, is creation. The created, that is. A simultaneity of life-death, where life and death are immortal complementaries. You see what's happened with us, with our dualistic consciousness? Life, 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 we crave for life. We cling to life. Death we put aside. Oh, mustn't talk about such things. Oh, gloomy talk. How will you know light without darkness? How will you know the cheerful without the gloomy? But the words cheerful and gloomy are equally misplaced. Death is an indispensable essential from the very moment we are conceived. Think for a moment, for a few moments. Immediately after conception, that fertilized cell begins to grow, we say. Normally, after 9 months, one fine day, you hear, bah! and your great parental pride is fully satisfied, and you say, ah, wonderful. The most wonderful child in the world, which is quite true. The most wonderful child in the world, your own child. You see? All right. And then that child grows and grows to its full stature. What is the meaning of growing? It is a changing, isn't it? Till you come to maturity. It's a changing. And what is the meaning of changing? You die to the present condition, giving birth to the new condition. Death is everlastingly with us. And after 3.5 million years on the globe, we are stupid enough to have our particular outlook and reaction against death. Understand death, and death will have no terrors for you. There comes a final change when the organism ceases to be a living organism. That is perfectly true. We consider it a loss. Not everybody, because there may be some bodies who say, thank goodness, now my daddy has left me £1 million and I can enjoy it. There are people like that. I know one person in India who is Sir somebody. I know him quite well because he lived in my house in London many years ago for a few months. And he used to keep saying of his father, Marto Nathi, he won't die. Those are the Gujarati words, you see, Marto Nathi. He won't die, he won't die. Now you see, people are like that. But if one understands death, one sees that it is the twin brother of life. Uh, I put here, death is in fact other life. Life and other life are in eternal interplay, creation, a constant fecundation of male, female, positive, negative. So, heaven endures constant, and earth's substance is displayed by the ever-changing garb of beauty. But that beauty is of heaven. In earth is the becoming process, which is sorrow as long as my mind is evil. When pure, that supernal beauty shines through the person here on earth. The person, unlike the body, is not mortal, not finite, and has no personality. In human terms, I never know that person. When my separate human personality, that illusory phantom, which is a sorry disharmony of conflicting attributes and disorderly change, is utterly empty of evils, the one infinite person shines unhindered. When the psyche, I have used the word mind here because that is the word which has been in common use, but now I use only the word psyche. We don't have a mind. None of us has a mind. Mind is that transcendent, invisible, formative mode of functioning of the creative energy, of the transcendent creative energy. We don't possess, you can't split up that which is eternal and infinite into countless bits and appropriate one of those bits for yourself. So I have no mind, but I certainly have a psyche just as much as I have a nose or ears or anything else. The psyche is a reality because it's actually functioning. And one can experience it, one can observe it, one can deal with it. Now, when the psyche is purified, it's the psyche which has evil in it. Out of the heart comes evil, as the Bible puts it. When the psyche is utterly purified, then that transcendent mode of functioning of the primordial creative energy, which we call mind, which Buddhism was called pure mind, Chinmatra. I think particularly Tibetan Buddhism. Correct me if I'm wrong. Chinmatra was the word, you see. Then that functions freely through you. Because that which is transcendent cannot function through you or me so long as there are obstructions in myself preventing that eternal light from shining freely. Our task is to free ourselves from our obstructions. Now, please understand, when I say free ourselves, I don't mean something like this. This, that, and the other piece of furniture is no good now. I throw it out of the window. You can't throw anything out of the window where actuality is concerned. You can understand it, you can transform it, ultimately transmute it. You understand the difference between transmutation and transformation. It is those are words which the science of chemistry has made very clear. When you transform something, you change its form. And that word is strong enough in most cases. But transmutation means this, that the particular chemical element is so changed that it has become a totally new element with different properties. radium, for instance, when it has radiated away all its energy and so forth, is changed into lead. You see? It's like that. That is transmutation. So, we are transmuted. St. Paul, of course, couldn't possibly use the word transmuted. You know, he says we are changed in the twinkling of an eye and all that sort of thing. That is true. But changed and transformed are not good words. Transmuted is the fact. This is what happens. Something utterly different has come into being. This is creation, if you like. In the Indian languages, God is Deva. Deva comes from the root div, meaning to shine. And it also means to give. So, those people thought of God as God the giver of life, the shining one, the giver of light. And also Aditya. Ditya means bound. Aditya means unbound. That means the unlimited, the utterly free. Whatsoever we do brings a consequence. Whatsoever we feel, think, speak, do, that sums up the modes in which we function. All that produces a consequence. Creation, the creative activity of transcendence, is without any consequence. Then you'll ask me, logically, quite logically, then what is the meaning of saying that transcendence creates the universe? Isn't the universe a consequence? Yes, in a sense, it is a consequence. And in a sense, it is decidedly not a consequence. It is a consequence which has no binding influence upon transcendence. Transcendence is utterly free, unbound, aditi, aditya. Whatsoever I do binds me. The consequence of whatever I do, think or speak, binds me. It's a limitation. You know why, if you understand this, you'll understand why Sri Krishna said, he who sees action in inaction, and inaction in action, sees truly. The action by transcendence is to us inaction. This action of transcendence in the theistic forms is, I think, generally presented as the will of God. God wills this, that and the other, and therefore this, that and the other came into being. But when we will anything, there is a binding consequence, always. My personality is in truth person usurper. Look at the way people regard personality. Oh, he's a great personality. Remarkable personality. All the famous actors and actresses and whatnot, you see, they are great personalities. Tragic. And the personality is cultivated. What exactly am I cultivating when I cultivate personality? An image of what I think I am. And your image is not a living thing, and it is not a true thing. So the cultivation of personality is the cultivation of untruth, of the image. And therefore it usurps the real person. The real person exists, is present in each and every single human being in the world. How often, I must have said it tens of thousands of times in these 26 years. Every person is transcendence embodied. Embodied not in the meaning that something from above the sky resides inside my head or my heart or liver or kidney or something. Not that. It's embodied in this sense that it constricted itself and became this material stuff. That is what we are. That is why great philosophers have said we are gods in the making. They had that insight. We are gods in the making. We are gods in the releasing, actually, not so much making. We make nothing. But we release the person, the transcendent, out of us. And the fulfillment of man, definitely then, I would say, is in the realization of this holistic consciousness, which is at home in eternity and infinity, which is its proper context. That doesn't mean that you will always function in that context. The world, in the last 6,000 years particularly, has seen many a perfected holy one who realized that consciousness and who functioned in it as such. But that doesn't mean that they function all 24 hours of the day like that. Because they, being alive in an organism which comes into being, which came into being, which grows, and which finally will inevitably die, has to awaken out of that consciousness. I put it badly, awaken out of that, because it is that consciousness where you are really awake. Oh, it is we who have to fall asleep out of that consciousness and be awake here in this limited consciousness. That's how it is. Consciousness has vanished. This vijnana, this discriminative consciousness, is not awake. It cannot be awake. Now, if even in sleep this consciousness disappears, and remember that the vigilance center in the brain here, you see, is responsible for...